Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When Beth Armstrong started working at the Columbus Zoo in the 1970s, state-of-the-art captive animal habitats were sparse and draconian. Magnificently intelligent and sensitive gorillas slept on concrete slabs in barren enclosures. Zoo managers had not yet learned the importance of creating facsimiles of natural habitats with enriching details instead of the stultifyingly boredom-creating outlets that they had at the time, nor were the bonds between animals and humans fully appreciated. Eventually, Armstrong rose in the ranks from part-timer to keeper to head keeper of the gorillas. She went on to champion conservation and continues to promote the role of zoos in the fieldwork that protects great ape species in the wild. Her forthcoming book is titled Voices from the Ape House. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Ann.
You know, when I read I think it was from something that Jack Hanna has said, that obviously host of Jack Hanna's Into the Wild and former zoo director, I guess. He says that you tell a story of a remarkable time in the era of zoos when things really changed, and you were at the forefront of that.
Well, I think, again, my fellow keepers and I, Charlene Gendry, Adele Absey, and Diana Frisch, we were lucky. We landed in a place and a time in the early 80s where great change needed to occur within zoos. And we were fortunate enough to work at a zoo where you were allowed the freedom to create an environment that would work for the animals. We were not micromanaged. We were listened to. It was unusual then. We still can look at each other. Charlene and Adele and I will look at each other and go, oh my gosh, we were so lucky to be there when we were. It was like having a blank canvas. And the management believed so much in their staff. And it wasn't just gorillas. I mean, what happened with polar bears and the eagle program and cheetah program and the nursery program, we were simply allowed. Jack trusted us. We thought things out. It's not like we just willy-nilly went towards making major changes. Mm-hmm. But we were supported in our logical steps towards getting things changed. And again, zoos at that time, not just Columbus, were on the edge where they absolutely had to change.
I remember before that time going to the zoo as a child. I think you and I are about the same age.
Yeah.
And I didn't like the zoos.
Yeah.
I went to John Ball Park in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes.
And now I think it's the Meyer. Is it still John Ball Park?
I think it may be. I'm not really sure.
And it was considered a pretty good zoo at the time, but I just made me sad.
It was disturbing.
It was typical, though.
Yeah.
And it was a turnoff for me. What I think is interesting is that you saw what the turnoff was. You saw the what wasn't working, but you still wanted to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I've had animal rights people ask me specifically, well, especially if I've given a talk about gorillas and talk specifically about Bongo, and they'll say, but why did you stay? And my response is, well, because if I'm in the system, if I was in the system, then I could make changes. I was in that fortunate position, myself and my fellow keepers, we were in the position that we could make those seismic changes. And I could stand outside and criticize all I wanted, but that wasn't going to make the change. And I also think there was that connection to individual animals, the real commitment to wanting their lives, whatever was left of their lives, that we had to make sure that they were comfortable and in a good place. And they were able to be gorillas as much as you can in a captive setting.
You start the book, I guess it's a prologue, and
yes,
it's practically Disney-like.
Yes.
In nature. It is so sad.
Yeah.
It starts in 1958. Tell us what you write about.
Well, it's a fictional account.
Right.
But it certainly mirrors what gorillas went through when they were captured from the wild. So if a hunter went out, if they were given an order for a baby gorilla, then the adult male, the silverback, was killed because he would protect his group. And bear in mind that gorilla groups may have 4 or 5 females, juveniles, infants, the silverback, and obviously the females, the mothers. And so the male would be killed. The black back would probably, the backup male would be killed. The mother would be killed.
All for one
baby. For one baby that often didn't survive. So I wanted to write that because I wanted people to understand that when I started in zoos, many of the gorillas we worked with in starting in 1980, early 80s, many of them were wild caught. So they carried with them that trauma and that history. In addition to what they went through and what they saw and the loss of their family members. And then, of course, then they lived for years in very sterile concrete cages. So that informed, I wanted to illustrate what they went through in order for us to even look at them. Because I think it was just, okay, put this into perspective.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly. I remember times when you were talking about going to the zoo in your hometown, going to the zoo when I was a kid, and I loved it, but I remember going in the ape house when it was open to the public and sitting on that bench when the crowds would leave and watch Bongo. I didn't really know it was Bongo mm-hmm. at the time. And seeing a sadness in my mind emanating from him. A sort of studied removing himself from the environment,
yeah.
just the look in his eye, and feeling such a sense of this isn't right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a story, I think it's about Bongo, where at some point he's given a bale of hay.
That's Mac. That's actually Colo's dad.
Okay.
So Colo and Millie were captured probably around 51, brought into the zoo. And then, of course, they had Colo, and Colo was pulled to hand rear, first gorilla born in captivity. And so when I met Mac, he was by himself. I never worked with Millie. She had passed away several years before I started. And so he lived isolated by himself in a cage. He didn't see very well. He kind of would always look at you sort of from the sides mm-hmm. of his eyes. It was a real sweetheart. He didn't vocalize a lot. Very laid back. But when we were renovating that building and shutting, we were eventually going to shut that building down to the public so the gorillas had their privacy, which was huge, by the way, for any zoo to do that. We housed the gorillas down at the old hospital, which is no longer at the zoo. And I remember Diana calling me on the walkie-talkie, our head keeper then, and said, come down to the hospital. And I opened the door to the keeper aisle, and I could hear him, Mac, chatting to himself, just this mwah, mwah, mwah sound, nonstop. And I had never heard him do that. And I walk around the corner, and Diana sort of holds her finger up to her lips, like, don't say anything. And she had given him almost a bale of hay. And he was creating the most magnificent nest I had ever seen. I mean, it was so uniform. It had high walls. It had a cupped center. He'd step out of it, sort of fuss with it, step back in, shake out some more hay. And that's, gorillas make nests on a daily basis. And I looked at him and I thought, my gosh, what are you remembering from your right. childhood? Because your mother would have made a nest for you in the wild. And
he'd never had the tools before.
No. So it was, I get chills even when I think about it now.
I do too. When I read that story, I was just torn between smiling and being very happy and being very sad.
That's it. It's all of those emotions. You're constantly struggling with trying to do right by these animals and recognizing what they went through. And I think, you know, we used to talk about this in the ape house, around the ape house kitchen. We were coming up with our ideas. Is for me, I felt that what we were trying to do was almost to lay at their feet an apology, and that we had to do everything within our power to make their lives comfortable. Yes, they were in a captive setting. We couldn't do anything about that, but we could make their lives more private. We could give them the things that they needed and back off and let them be gorillas. That was the ticket. We didn't intervene. We always thought, what's going to make them feel comfortable in this environment so that they can just get on with their life as a gorilla?
Which is what, if you're thinking about captive animals, what and why we do this, why we have zoos, yeah. is what we really want to see.
Exactly. Yeah.
There was another story you told, and I think this had to do, you were more talking about food, but it goes to the nesting issue too, which I never knew before
yeah.
about about gorillas is how one of the gorillas, I think it was a female, would take the food, like carrot and celery sticks, and make a circle around herself.
That was actually a chimpanzee.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. And that
they,
was.
They nest as well?
Yes. Emily did that. And that would break my heart as well. Because she and Coco, the male chimp, were in another holding area, and we couldn't give them hay either because we didn't have a way to get them out of the cages to clean out. So, and she was the sweetest, sweetest animal. And I would come in the morning or after I'd fed and I'd come back to clean, and she would literally have her carrot pieces. It's in a perfect circle.
Yeah.
And it just broke my heart that we couldn't give her what she really needed at that time.
And then tell me about the cleanings. You still cleaned their cages.
But they were in them.
So what? Why did hay or that kind of a thing?
Because we didn't have options to move them out to get it.
And it took longer if there was hay that you...
Well, it wasn't so much that. If it were wintertime, we couldn't really move them out to their side holding cages,
okay.
Those old barred ones.
Yeah.
So it was more a technical thing, and it was also... Maybe it just hadn't occurred to some of the people that came before me and before myself and my fellow keepers. But, you know, once we figured things out, renovated that building, built the gorilla habitat, which is in essence a huge cage,
yeah.
Which works for gorillas. That's why we built it.
Yeah.
And the Columbus Zoo went against zoo trends. Back then, everybody was doing the naturalistic exhibit, which is in essence was it might have looked good, but did it work for gorillas? And our thought was, what is going to make them feel most safe, most comfortable, allow them options in their daily lives that they can get away, hang out with their friends. But if somebody comes by that they're not really fond of in the troop, that they can get up and over and say, hey, I'm not interested in getting into a fight with you. So I'm going to exit by using the mesh as a three-dimensional escape route inside that exhibit. So everything we did was based on what will work for them to allow them to be gorillas in a captive setting, as close as we can mirror it to the wild.
I think one of your greatest acts of brilliance, and there are so many that I read about in the book you've written, was when you went to Amsterdam.
Oh, that was, yeah. Lucky me.
You went, but you paid your own. They gave you a leave of absence.
But see,
you paid your own way. You found a place to stay.
Yeah.
I was just like, what? You're 20-something?
Yeah.
Broke?
Yeah, broke.
And you scraped together the money, and you went because you just knew that there had to be some answers there.
Yeah. But let me say this. How many zoos would have even given me the leave of absence? Many would not have.
Okay.
So that is wonderful in and of itself. And, you know, we were just discussing just a few minutes ago before we went on air about follow these little things that fall, these little stones that fall in your path. All those things added up to why did Oppenheim in the Netherlands, the facility that housed gorillas and other primates and was so brilliant. Why did that come on my radar screen in 1985? Why did I meet someone from Holland, Joke van Laar, and then I ended up renting her apartment? Why did Oppenheim allow me to come and
I wondered about
work
that.
There?
Yeah.
I just wrote him a letter.
Can I go?
You're like, can I come and hang out with your gorillas? And I learned so much from them because of their how laid back they were and how common sense it was. It was really just reinforcing what we in the Ape House, myself and my fellow keepers, already, we got it. We just were sort of grabbing everywhere to get as much information as possible. And even when I came back and we would have a birth, say, we would, you know, if we saw a behavior that might be alarming to some of our other staff members, we could get on the horn and call Oppenheim, call Franz Kaiser and say, hey, here's what we're seeing. This is what she's doing with the baby. What do you think? So those sort of connections were super important. But I do think it's so important for this younger generation coming up, be they people in the zoo field or up-and-coming conservationists, be willing to volunteer. Be willing to pay your own way to get those experiences under your belt. Those experiences are worth more than probably anything.
My guest is Beth Armstrong. She's former head keeper of the gorilla exhibit at the Columbus Zoo, conservationist, author of a new book. It's forthcoming. It's titled Voices from the Ape House. If you have a question or comment for Beth Armstrong, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. When you would talk about smelling... Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the evolution of zoo habitats and conservation, as well as the Columbus Zoo and its Ape House in particular, with Beth Armstrong, former head keeper of the Ape House. Her forthcoming, it is now out, and I apologize for that. It's titled Voices from the Ape House. You can get it on Amazon or Ohio State Press.
OSU Press.
OSU Press. So it's already out. Been reading an advanced reader's copy. I don't know if the photos are in color or not,
no.
But there's lots of, you know, there's enough pictures. You could always use more, but the cover picture is of you, Beth Armstrong, with a baby.
Yep, Jamoki.
And it's cropped. And you said what you loved about that picture was actually something that you can't see.
Yeah, part of the photo is that her hand is gripping the back of my ponytail. And for some reason, there's something very endearing about that.
Yeah.
The Tom and Jan Parks, which are a couple that are very much into gorillas. They don't work with gorillas, but they take wonderful photographs. And I happened to find this photo in a box of old photos and tracked them down and said, would you mind if we put that on the cover? And they were kind enough to do it. This is Jamoki. And I have to tell you, when the night she was born, we all in the Ape House looked at each other and went, oh my gosh, that is the most beautiful baby gorilla we've ever seen. I mean, she was just stunning from the moment.
Every baby isn't beautiful.
No. But she was a stunner. She was gorgeous. Yeah. Yeah.
That whole thing, the whole maternity ward issue and what happened to the babies after birth.
Being pulled.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Being pulled, which was standard operational procedure forever.
Yep.
And you mentioned that you were calling the outfit in Amsterdam once you knew that they were able to leave them with the parents. Mm-hmm. There's a story. I apologize that I can't remember all the names of everybody, but it might have been Bongo. I don't know. But the first time you ever let a newborn stay with its parents and what that was like for the male.
It was the way it should be.
He had already had lots of kids.
Bongo had had three infants with Colo. Okay. And all three babies, that was Emmy, Oscar, and Tony. And Tony is still out at the Columbus Zoo, as a surrogate mom, raising babies. Uh-huh. Good on Tony. The first time we knew that the gorillas, and I have to say this very carefully because I don't want to sound patronizing. We knew the gorillas were probably the best of parents. They just had never been given the opportunity because of our inability to see it and our inability to give them privacy or understand that they've got it all figured out. We just need to give them what they need, the nesting materials, privacy, stick to routine, and they're really seriously the most wonderful, gentle parents you will ever see. And so when we found out Bridge was pregnant and she was with Bongo, it was like, that's it. And I remember when Bridge had Fosse and then Bongo was quietly just vocalizing to Bridget through the birth. And he tried to touch Fosse within 24 hours. And it was pretty comical because Bridge is sort of sitting up against the mesh and she's got Fosse down in sort of her legs are crossed down in this crotch pocket area. And he's asleep and Bongo's sitting right next to her. And he's desperate to touch that. I mean, it was just like, ooh. And he would reach, and his fingers were massive. I mean, massive. And he would take his index finger and try and touch the baby's head. And she would just push his hand away, not even look at him. And he always looked like he was busted, like he was, you know, in the candy store and he got caught stealing something. And it went on forever. And even at one point, he kind of like turned away and bit his thumb, like he didn't know what to do.
Excited.
He was so excited.
In a dither, kind of
yeah,
in a dither.
Kind of. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. And it was about 24 hours later that I saw it, that he reached over and literally took this massive index finger, stroked Fosse's head, his son, and then smelled his finger and then sort of closed his eyes. And I was like, ah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Oh, Kathleen in Columbus, you're on the air with Beth Armstrong, former head keeper of the gorilla exhibit at the Columbus Zoo. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. I went to see Bongo. I saw him in the zoo when I was, 12 or so, and I'm 73 now, and it just has haunted me because I had seen Creature of the Black Room Morgue, and I went, ooh, look, scary gorilla. And my father pointed out how inhumane his habitat was. He had it was a concrete cell with a sort of divided place with a wooden plank on it that he could sleep on. And my father said, well, see, now that's warmer than the floor. And Bongo threw up his lunch and then ate it. And my father taught me to be sad for him. And when I hear, so it's kind of haunted me all these years.
Yeah.
Well, I think again that for me, it haunted me as well. But I do think that people need to realize that zoos have figured it out over the last 30 years. And, you know, if you get on line now and you look at all the mothers and fathers, it's standard operating procedures that gorillas are given much more privacy. They raise their babies together. It's done a complete turnaround. And I think that disturbing scene that you described, that pushed us to move forward and make a change and being willing to make huge changes within the zoo world.
Thank you, Kathleen, for that call. Anybody else, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Again, my guest is Beth Armstrong. Her new book is titled Voices from the Ape House. Beth Armstrong is former head keeper of the gorilla exhibit at the Columbus Zoo, a former keeper at the zoos going back into the 70s. She was a volunteer, I think you started out as.
Either 79 or 80, I started as a volunteer. Back in the day where you just sort of showed up at the children's zoo barn, it was a lot loosey. It was more loosey-goosey back then. It's a little bit more formal now. Super lucky to have worked with people like Don Wright, who headed up the children's zoo barn. And eventually that morphs into other things. Again, like we were talking, you keep gathering these experiences and all of a sudden doors start opening.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like to take risks with the gorillas. And like, for instance, when you allowed the baby to stay with the parents for the first time, was it nerve-wracking? And
no, because
you already knew it was possible.
No, because I think, again, you always take your lead from the gorillas. They will tell you everything you need to know. And that was a given that needed to happen. But at the same time, we were doing, the mother-father rearing was happening. We also realized there's a whole generation of kids that were being pulled and hand-raised, and they needed to get back in with gorillas right away. And that's where we came up with the surrogate gorilla program, which is adoptive moms and dads taking on the role. Here's the deal. Gorillas always knew how to be gorillas. They understand everything that needs to happen. We, as humans, simply weren't allowing them. And again, Columbus allowed us to create an environment. We gave them privacy. We took our lead from the gorillas. Their behavior always indicated whether or not they wanted to be a surrogate mother or a surrogate dad. And as long as you followed their lead, everything turned out okay. Yes, the surrogate program was probably risky because we were putting in an unrelated male silverback, 400 pounds, in with a baby after, you know, the surrogate mother had adopted it and other group members had been integrated. But we didn't know what would happen. And that's something I want to say to the people of Columbus and Franklin County. You should be really, to me, I'm very proud of the fact that Columbus didn't follow the norms or the trends. They saw things that needed to get done and they simply got on with it. And it may have pushed back against what was happening in other zoos, but it, both in the field of gorilla husbandry and then certainly in the field of supporting field conservation around the world, Columbus was out there in front, not waiting for other zoos to say, this is what we should do. I really think the residents of this area should be so proud of what that zoo has done to support conservation around the world.
That is like sort of the mission. It yeah. feels like now
that's it.
Of the Columbus Zoo
yeah.
that you spend as much time, if you're paying attention, reading about at the exhibits mm-hmm. about what mm-hmm. the zoo is doing and what it's supporting in other places in the world, as you do reading about who's behind
right.
Right. The plexiglass or the right. glass that day. Let's see. Stephen in Newark, you're on the air with Beth Armstrong. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I'd like to relate an experience I had at the Ape House once around 1990 or so. I was a Cub Scout leader at the time, and we were having a overnight camp out at the zoo. And they let us into the Ape House sometime after hours. It was dark. I don't know how late. But they warned us we should be quiet because this is their private time. For the family. There was the male, a female, and a juvenile in there. And, of course, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old kids being kids weren't very quiet. And I was sort of standing there trying to shush them. And at one point, I was standing by the glass, and the male tapped on the glass right by my face. And I sort of turned over and looked at him. And he looked in my eyes with an expression that was as human as you could imagine. He was angry. He was upset about being having their privacy invaded. And, you know, since that point, I have never been able to think of them as just animals.
Oh. Well, you know, I tell people all the time, and this is the way we sort of conducted ourselves in the Ape House in terms of my fellow keepers and myself. It was, what would we feel like? Put ourselves in their position. This is their home. And to walk down the back aisle, that's why we always whistled or talked to ourselves, because we didn't want to come up on a gorilla and frighten them. Huh. And also bringing people into the Ape House or somehow going near the gorilla exhibit at nighttime when it is their private time. And there is a story in the book about, I was really worried about one of our young gorillas. It was Cora. And she had a really, really, really bad cold. And so I ran back out to the zoo at 11 o'clock at night, and I we always did hot onion soup with lots of vitamin C. We did all sorts of herbal stuff, which was great. And I went around to check on her at 11. And I remember the look on her face and the look on Mumba's face, her male, and the other group members. It was basically, what are you doing here? We're sleeping. What? And I was so embarrassed that I had intruded on there. I gave her the soup, which she was fine with, and then she trundled over and went back to sleep. But it really was a lesson for me about intruding on their private space. And, you know, one other story I want to share, it's not in the book, but, you know, when I was at the zoo in the spring, a lot of the school kids would come out, busloads of kids, and there'd be a lot of teenage boys. And getting around gorillas, they can get a little rambunctious, just to say the least. But here's what would happen. I would come out, and I wouldn't yell at these kids. I'd go talk to them, and I'd teach them gorilla vocalizations, and I'd say, hey, you guys, think about it. If this were your home, and some strangers came wandering through your front door, just banged it open, and started yelling and screaming, think about how stressed you would be, how frightened you would be. You need to think about that when you're viewing them. And then I pointed out some behaviors that they could pick up on. It worked always with those kids. They would quiet down. They'd start watching. They'd start talking to each other and say, hey, did you see what that gorilla just did? What does that mean? Or they'd do a little vocalization. And I think that's the thing about gorillas. They, in some ways, make us uncomfortable because they mirror us so, so closely, but they remind us to be very sensitive to other species, all other species.
Stephen, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to talk to you. When I go to the zoo, when I go to the ape house and I watch them, and I love watching where there would be some juveniles way at the
top, goofing around.
Jumping around and goofing around, taking turns trying to jump to get over something. And then, you know, one of the males, adults, is laying around, you know, just kind of, I don't know, the females have maybe a couple babies hanging on to them. And it's just this whole world going on, and you don't know because you're there for such a short amount of time as a visitor. But to be able to actually associate personalities with them, we do it with our pets, our dogs, and stuff like that.
Right.
But we, you know, I can't. These are advanced species. These are intelligent beings. And I just am fascinated by your stories about all of their different personalities.
Yeah. And, you know, not only do they physically look very individual.
Yeah.
Their body build, their facial aspects, but they have very individual personalities, and you learn that, and you learn the quirks of some and the expectations of others. And again, that's the greatest thing about for me when I was a gorilla keeper is it's the observation time, because the gorillas, if they were ill or if something was going on within the group and maybe somebody was making a power play or whatever, if you sit and watch them, they will tell you every time exactly what's going on. And it's learning the individual personalities.
You tell a story about, you know, by now they get a lot of variety of food. You're always, you know, it's just part of the whole experience. But one day you throw an orange into one of the...
To Bongo.
Bongo.
Yeah.
And he throws it back.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? You know, and you go back and forth. Tell that story because, wow.
Yeah. This story happened after... Now, bear in mind, it was the old building, so it was still open to the public. So whenever you went to feed, in essence, you were between the public and, even though you were in the keeper aisle, you were in between the gorillas and the public. And so if they were agitated, they were going to take it out on you. So be it. Well-deserved. They had, you know... But so for 6 weeks, I had been working with gorillas, and Bongo was pretty tough. Colo was tough, and he hadn't been all that friendly, which is fine. You just go about your business. You kind of coasted to neutral. You don't look at them straight on. You look off to the side. You very carefully put their food in the cage, but you don't get too close because they can reach out and grab. And I put in an orange, which is really their favorite. That was their favorite item, usually. And Bongo quietly picked it up and just pushed it back. And it dropped on the keeper aisle in front of his cage. And I thought, uh-oh, what's he doing? Is he trying to get me to come closer? I mean, I don't know what's going on.
Uh-huh.
So I pick it up and I gently put it back in carefully and then back up. And he does it again. And then... And then I do it again, and he pushes it out again, and I swear, and then he vocalizes to me sort of this wah sound, which is basically, come on, Beth.
Duh.
Yeah, really. And I realized.
And you said he kind of rolled his eyes a little bit or something?
No, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I'm sure he didn't, but in my mind, looking back on it, I can think, he must have just thought, for God's sake, Beth, don't you get what I'm trying to go for here? He wanted me to peel it and then take the sections and place them along the bar. And he just leaned over and just slurped, slurped, slurped each one. And I remember thinking after 6 weeks, I've crossed into another realm here, because what he's saying to me is, I trust you.
Right.
I trust you with my most favored item. You're all right. You've passed some sort of test. And I was elated. Literally walking back into the ape house kitchen, I'm like doing a little jig because I thought, oh my God, Bongo actually likes me, or at least he accepts my presence.
Yeah.
And that was good enough for me.
You don't disgust him anymore.
No, he's just like, who are you?
Oh my gosh. My guest is Beth Armstrong. She's former head keeper of the gorilla exhibit at the Columbus Zoo, author of a new book. It's titled Voices from the Ape House. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the evolution of zoo habitats and conservation, as well as the Cumbalumbus Zoo and its ape house in particular, with Beth Armstrong, former head keeper of the ape house. Her new book is titled Voices from the Ape House. If you have a question or comment, it's nice to hear the memories too, folks. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's the gorillas, then there are the chimpanzees, mm-hmm. and there are all these other species out there that you interacted with. Mm-hmm. The gorillas were your favorite.
Yes.
But you had a lot of other, I mean, how did you suss that out? What was it about them that?
I think there's a quietness about them. They're low key. Anyone will tell you about my family, the Armstrong family. we're not into drama. Let's just put it that way. So we're pretty quiet about things. We don't like.
Okay.
So I think there was something about gorillas. I think they're so beautiful in their way, and they're regal. They're funny. They have a sense of humor. They're kind, they're gentle, they form friendships. They're, you know, and I know I said this earlier, but if you want an example of what great parenting is, watch the fathers and the moms take care of the kids. Nobody gets hit. There's a way of disciplining a baby or a baby that's a little out of step that you just kind of do the, which means, I see what you're doing over there. You might want to step back from that a little bit. And you know, usually the kids are like, I'm in trouble. It's a very gentle way. And I know we were talking about earlier about the juveniles. When you go out to the zoo, you see the juveniles and the infants. You know, that's what we knew, my colleagues and I knew in the ape house, that the adults were more than capable of being adults. We just had never allowed them to, and I'm saying that collectively, in uh-huh. zoos in the early 80s. And we knew that the juveniles needed to have the discipline from adults in relation to infants, or in relation to that they can get pretty rambunctious and just sort of naughty in their own right. So it would take a silverback male to sort of lumber to his feet, and you can see him sort of go, oh, God, here we go again. And he's got to walk over. And all it takes is that silverback or even the adult female to get up and stand with on their knuckles.
You
and
made
stiff.
Me have to get up.
I know. And then the kids are like, oh, I'm in trouble. I mean, they're funny to watch. But I do think, and the key is we knew that that the juveniles needed to be disciplined in relation to how they treated infants, because they were going to go on to be parents and they needed to know what their parameters were, and they needed to know that being gentle. Can I tell the story
sure.
about the twins? You know, the twins really picked on JJ. JJ was our first infant that was adopted into the surrogate group, and Colo, although it was her grandson. She adopted him. Whether or not she knew it was her grandson, I'm not really sure. Mumba was the silverback. There were other group members. The twins were in the group. And they could tag team Jay. And they could get pretty darn rough with Jay until every once in a while, Grandma, as we called Colo, would lumber to her feet and intervene. But there was one time, for some reason, when I was bringing them inside, and it was a kind of chilly fall day, overcast, and Colo left him outside, JJ. Now, he's an infant, a youngster at that point. He's probably a year. And he's stuck in the overhead chute. And it's hard. it's easy to push through the chute to get out, which has a plastic flap to keep the heat in the building. It's not so easy. You can't really push through to go in. You have to sort of lift the flap to go under.
And that's
and
a skill.
And it's quite heavy. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, she left him outside. And so I'm trying to figure, I'm talking to him from below. And he's in the overhead chute. And all of a sudden, one of the twins comes out. Now, these are the kids that have been picking on JJ nonstop since he's been integrated into the group. And he literally puts his arm around his shoulder and walks him down to the plastic flap, lifts it up for Jay to get in. And JJ scoots on in and then joins the rest of the group.
Aww.
Now, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we still, the Columbus Zoo still has one of the twins. It's Mac, who's a surrogate dad and a biological dad as well. So, yeah, these really sort of magical moments of seeing the sweetness and the kindness and the ability, I think, to empathize with other group members kind of brings you up short. Yeah.
Jesse Carter sent us an email, says, "Ann, your gorilla segment brings back one of my most vivid memories from my OSU years. A winter quarter course in physical anthropology included a field trip to see the apes at the Columbus Zoo one cold, rainy Saturday morning in 1980. A woman who addressed us in the gorilla house looked around during her talk to check whether any zoo personnel were within earshot. When she saw the coast was clear, she became very passionate and emotional about the conditions in which the gorillas were housed. She said they are bored to death in this concrete block prison. That's why they jump at people and smear feces on the windows. It's one of my most vivid memories of an instructional moment throughout my 4 years at OSU. I'll bet your guests this morning might know who that person was."
Honestly, I don't know, truthfully.
Obviously, it was frustrating. I want you to talk about your finding your voice programs. But first, let's hear from Jill in Upper Arlington. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I have a teenage daughter who is really interested in animal behavior. And we were just wondering what your guests might say as far as recommendations for college majors or careers that she's growing into. She would love the story. She's in school right now.
I have a degree in anthropology, and that's really the ticket.
Yeah.
I think when I figured, and I got it from OSU, and actually I had been working in the Ape House for 5 years, and then I went back to school between the ages of 30 and 34 to get my undergraduate degree. And I say this to people all the time, do both. Get your practical experience and your hands-on everyday experience, and that in combination with an undergraduate degree, at least. I know many people go on to get their master's and PhD. It depends on what she wants to do. But anthropology, I think when I finally figured out in my 20s that, hey, they actually give a degree for watching what I've always loved to do, which is observe people, observe animals, and most especially observe non-human primates, and that's anthropology. And Ohio State has a good program.
And then the follow your voice or
finding
your
voice,
inspirational stories from women who protect wildlife and wild places. Tell me about that program and why that's something that you pursued.
That came about because I'm still very involved in doing conservation work, and I decided to start hosting a weekend for women conservationists down at my place in Florida in the winter to get them out of the the tough weather. And all they had to do was pay their flight. And I love to cook. And we would sit around and talk. And it was really a moment to take stock, to see where we were all at in terms of our conservation work and how we could assist one another and help each other when we hit brick walls moving forward. And that just morphed into recognizing that there was a whole generation of up-and-coming conservationists or zoo people that we thought at least we could share our stories to say, these are the hurdles that we had to get over. These are the things that we believed in very strongly. These are bits and pieces of advice that as you move forward in your career as a conservationist, that please tap into our experience. Yours is going to be completely different, but do know that we believe in you. You believe in yourself. And I think what we found was there was a real need for just stories. And so when we have our women conservationists come to give these talks, they're not giving us their data. We don't want your data. We don't want your graphs. tell us a story of that little girl that used to read a lot of books about animals or played outside all the time. How did she become the head of conservation at a major zoo? Or how did she start a project in Uganda or in Madagascar? Who was that kid?
And that's how you start your book.
Yeah. 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 Because I think our childhood, we were speaking earlier, but, you know, I was blessed to grow up in Clintonville in the 60s here in Columbus. And it's a magical place. It was magical then. It was a time where kids went out and played. We had to deal with one another. We had to figure out our primate way around who were the kids in the neighborhood we liked and who were the kids that scared us a little bit. We had to work our way through our social system in our neighborhood. And because we were outdoorsy kids, because our parents wouldn't have tolerated us hanging around the house all the time, mm-hmm. I think that's how, even in a suburban setting, you become very exposed to the changing of the seasons and the beauty of the seasons and the beauty of wildlife that you see just in your suburban neighborhood.
Have you, we know the zoo has changed. Zoos across the country
yes.
are changing. Columbus has changed amazingly,
yes.
every little bit about it. Do you see how the people who visit the zoo are changing? Is there, can you see a response from visitors?
I do know that in my work with a conservation conference that we host every couple of years, not with the Columbus Zoo started it, by the way, mm-hmm. In 1995, but it has gone on to be a conference that is now being hosted by other zoos every couple of years. And the point of it is to bring together field people and zoo people in order to get more support for field work that's going on all in community-based education programs all over the world dealing with the natural world. The newest, the one that's upcoming is in June in Salt Lake City. The Hogle Zoo is the host. And I think what we're seeing is that this newer generation is saying, we expect our zoos to be doing conservation. And I will keep going back to, I am so proud of the Columbus Zoo in the 1990 was way out in front of that and said, nope, we will be conservation. We are going to walk the walk. We're not going to just talk about the importance of our visitors understanding conservation. We will create relationships around the world with the people that are on the front lines of conservation. And those will be the stories that will be shared with the visiting public. That was my experience at Columbus, you know, 30 years ago. What I'm seeing now is this newer generation is saying to all zoos, we want to see your commitment to field conservation. And I think that's brilliant.
Do you visit the zoo all the time?
No, I don't go out there.
Do you miss it? Do you miss the gorillas?
I'll go out because I do photography. So I'll go out every once in a while. And I have a couple of times over. I left Columbus in the latter part of 2000. And they've called me back a couple times to do, once was a consulting and the other one was a consulting with a new mom and baby. And their staff at the time was a new staff and they hadn't really been around a mom and a baby. So I felt so fortunate just to go back and really just hang out and watch gorillas uh-huh. again. And I have to say that staff is phenomenal at Columbus, what they do with the gorillas and their programs with the bonobos and a variety of other species. But I do go out. I'll get a craving. It's almost like I want to go and I want to see, but I want to smell the gorillas.
Yeah.
And I would go out when I was in the process of writing this, just to sort of a reminder.
Get the vibe.
Yeah. A reminder. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Beth Armstrong, former head keeper of the gorilla exhibit at the Columbus Zoo, a conservationist, author of a new book titled Voices from the Ape House. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, I just can't tell you, recommend the book enough. It's really, I want to go back and read it.
Oh, good.
At the Ape House and just read it because, and there's a really cute picture of a baby gorilla on the front too.
Yeah.
Or it is a gorilla, right?
Yeah.
So check out the book, Voices from the Ape House, and thank you so much for listening today. I want to thank the All Sides staff, producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matthew Rand, All Sites interns, Atiya Turi, Bobby Gerberic, Max Garrison, with video production by Nick Payne. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.